during the Dhamma talk, we discussed wisdom as a mental factor and how wisdom unfolds. And owing to a lack or limitation of time, we had to stop. And today, we shall continue with this unfolding of wisdom. And remember, yesterday I mentioned towards the end that one insight knowledge matures gradually, just like Swiss cheese. It takes time for it to really become mature. And likewise, in the meditation practice, in one insight knowledge, you will find one period where material phenomena are predominant, and then you will find a phase where the feelings are predominant, and then perceptions are predominant, and then mental formations, and finally consciousness might be predominant. But as mentioned already yesterday, this pattern may not be so obvious at the very beginning of one's meditation practice. And one goes through treads this path of insight, then one can, for the first time, then it's like seeing only the very tip of an iceberg, or experiencing the tip of an iceberg. So the experiences don't go very deep. However, when you practice for a longer period of time and you go beyond what is known as the first path, you might find that your practice becomes much, much deeper. And as it becomes deeper, it will also become wider. So if an insight knowledge during the first part of one's practice takes maybe just 2 or 3 days, then later on you may find that the same insight knowledge or contemplation might take many more days. So there are many more experiences that something come up. And at times the experiences can get quite, or the structure that lies behind a meditator's experiences might become quite complicated. And when it comes to the unfolding of wisdom or particular insight knowledge, then oftentimes a new understanding is gained with the observation of the rising and falling movement of the abdomen, since this is the primary object. However, if you were to use a pain as your primary object, well, then you would see it. You would have that intuitive understanding in relationship to the pain, and then as your insight knowledge matures, it will usually happen that also with regard to other objects occurring either in the body or in the mind, you start seeing the same thing. And so finally also with regard to mental formations, and so even including the sense doors. So if you see, for instance, the fast arising and passing wave formations with regard to the rising movement and falling movement of the abdomen, and it's really clear, then at a later point it may very well happen that the same kind of or similar kind of experience occurs with regard to the hearing process. So while listening very carefully to a particular sound, you notice that this sound is coming, going, or the hearing process has this nature of coming and going. And then with regard to the virtues of the Buddha, of wisdom, it is said in the Iti Wutaka that among all beings the Buddha is most noble, among all physical and mental phenomena, wisdom, banya, is most noble. And why is this? Because when wisdom is accomplished, all wholesome dhammas or wholesome mental states are accomplished. And in a different passage of the Jatakas, it says, among all dhammas or all factors contributing to the realization of nibbana, it is wisdom or panya which that is most noble, and the other mental factors are the followers of wisdom. And it is said in the Samyutta Nikaya that among all living beings, those who possess wisdom are most noble. So this is a particular feature of Buddhism, that those who have gained the most degree of wisdom are respected most. And so, when it comes to generosity, then the idea is, if you give something to an arahant, to a Buddha, or if you give something to a Buddha, it will merit, or it will bring about the greatest merit, and or high degree of merit. And if you give something to the Sangha, including the Buddha, then this will give an even greater merit. And if you give something to a person who has become an anagami, a non-returner, then this will give somewhat less positive results. So it's not as meritorious as giving something to a Buddha, or the Buddha plus the Sangha. And so this principle is then being adhered to all the way down to the once returners, the stream enterers, and then the puttujanas. So things are organized by way of wisdom. And this may be different from other religious traditions, and for some of you it might be difficult to relate to. Now, it is also said that the arising of wisdom leads to happiness, to peace and happiness. So wholesome, other wholesome qualities. So when we undertake this practice of Vipassana, in the end it's not just a pessimistic practice, but rather in the end there are very positive results that go along with it. Thing, connection is that of or correlation is that of wisdom and virtue, banya and sila. And we can say, based on the text, especially the Samyutta Nikaya, that with the attainment of stream entry, according to the commentaries, a meditator will no longer violate the five precepts. So the five precepts will be respected and observed very carefully. And these five precepts will not be broken in any way, and one will not even be tempted to drink a glass of wine or a glass of beer. Now, with the attainment of the first level of enlightenment, namely stream entry, three fetters get uprooted from the mind, namely the fetter of the wrongful belief in the existence of a self or soul. This is Sakkaya Ditthi in the Pali scriptural language. And then, furthermore, skeptical doubt, vicikicca, skeptical doubt in let's say, the practice and so, you know, the Dhamma, the Buddha, and so on. You know, and the third fetter is that of believing in rites and rituals as a means of attaining, you know, the goal. So basically, from the point of view of mental defilements, we have two mental defilements that get uprooted. One is skeptical doubt, and the other one is or two views, or it comes under wrongful view. And when you look at these two mental defilements that get uprooted from the mind, then you find that a view is still a relatively mild defilement. So it's not going very deep into the mind as yet. With the attainment of the first path of enlightenment, greed and hatred are not yet fully uprooted. So they still exert an influence over over the mind and over our actions. However, with the attainment of the first path, greed and hatred will be reduced to some extent. And because the two mental defilements that get uprooted from the mind with this first path experience, because of this, oftentimes the behavior of a meditator may not change that drastically. And others may say, oh, well, he or she is just the same as before. There's no major change in behavior, external behavior. However, the meditator himself or herself will know that certain changes have taken place. And so please do not expect that with the attainment of the first path, you then get rid of all your worldly problems. You will not. And so a number of them, especially those who are rooted or which are rooted in greed and in hatred and the remaining defilements, those will still continue to bother you. And it is only with the attainment of the third level of enlightenment that goes much, much, much deeper that greed and hatred will be removed from the stream of consciousness. And this experience usually goes about with a tremendous change in behavior. And so that even outsiders can see, oh, this person is not the same anymore. And imagine a person totally free from greed and hatred. Just simply no more ill will, no more irritation, no more grudge, no more discontentment, and so on. And that will definitely make a big difference in life. Now, you can imagine that if a person or a meditator continues with his or her practice and eventually gains the final path of arahantship or path of a holy one, and then this brings about drastic changes. With this, pride and conceit goes, with this, restlessness goes, and sloth and torpor, and also ignorance. Ignorance being the most difficult among the unwholesome mental states to be uprooted. And once a meditator has gained the second path, with this already greed and hatred will be substantially reduced, and as a result of this, less transgressions in terms of nisila will take place, or just human behavior. And once greed and ill will are gone altogether, then no more transgressions of that, transgressions based in or rooted in greed or hatred can occur. So the potential is simply gone. And when the potential in the mind for some greedy act, for some hateful act is gone, then these actions simply don't take place anymore. Now, as for the connection between wisdom and concentration, the Dhammapada verse says that these are, both of them are connected. And verse 372 says, there can be no concentration in one who lacks wisdom. And there can be no wisdom in one who lacks concentration. So this second part is more obvious, especially for Vipassana meditators. He or she who has concentration as well as wisdom is indeed close to Nibbana. And so, maybe as for an elaboration or an explanation for the first part of the verse, namely, there can be no concentration in one who lacks wisdom. A person who doesn't have any wisdom will not necessarily be interested in undertaking jhana practice, the practice of the absorptions. And thus, certain concentration cannot arise. Or, to put it even in a wider sense, again, a person who has no initial wisdom, no right reflections or power of reflection, such a person will not understand that it is indeed important to develop concentration, and thus will ignore this. Texts speak of four modes of progress to deliverance. And there is one which is known as dukkha-patipada danda-abhinya, painful progress with slow progress, with slow comprehension. And then we have painful progress with quick comprehension. Then we have pleasant progress with slow comprehension, and the last category is the one that all of you want to be in, namely pleasant progress with quick comprehension. However, meditators are different. One person different meditators perfections or abilities are different, and thus for some it takes very little time to progress, and for others it takes slightly longer. But in the end, this doesn't matter, as long as one continues to practice with patience and determination, one is bound to get there. And in Burma, they have a nice, in the meditation centers, they have a nice saying: if as a meditator you want to go to the Shwedagon Pagoda, which is probably the most well-known pagoda in all of Burma, which is in Yangon itself, then first of all you have to direct the body in the right direction, and namely the direction of the Shwedagon Pagoda, and then just set one foot in front of the other and just keep walking. And if you keep doing this, slowly, slowly, gradually, you'll get there. Even if it's that takes time. So, now, having explained some of the general features of wisdom and the unfolding of wisdom, let us now take a look at the, so to speak, the key to the exercises that you've been doing so far. At school, you have certain books, school books that teach you a certain subject, and then there'll be exercises there for arranged progressively, and in the back occasionally the keys will be given. So the key to what we have done so far is as follows. When a meditator comes to a retreat or joins a retreat, then he or she will start by keeping the by taking and keeping the precepts. And the next step then will be the restraint, the practice of the restraint of the senses. And if this meditator then starts practicing, then he or she will gradually come in contact with the rising and falling movement of the abdomen. And so, gradually, for some people, it happens very quickly, just a day or so, and others may take maybe a day or two longer, but gradually they'll come to discern that, first of all, the rising movement is different from the falling movement. The sensations occurring in the rising are not the same, that usually not, than the sensations occurring in the falling movement. And so then meditators also come to discern the specific sensations in the rising movement and the falling movement of the abdomen. Now, having gained a little bit of the skill in observation, then the next common experience is the battle with the wandering mind. So a meditator discovers that instead of staying with the rise and fall all the time, the mind wanders. It goes here and there, it goes into the past and into the future. And so a meditator most likely, or on the average, will also come across another common mental state, and this is what? Sleepiness, there you go, sloth and torpor. So, wandering mind and sloth and torpor are very common at the beginning of a retreat. Now, after a few days of intensive practice, things get difficult. And things get difficult when what arises in one's practice? The five hindrances, there you go, quite correct. And so, and when you look at it, theoretically, it must be like this. Sense desire in itself is already difficult. And then ill will, even more so. And sloth and torpor is not easy to take. And then restlessness and remorse are also two difficult mental states. Skeptical doubt is a difficult mental state. So when these hindrances arise, a meditator usually has a hard time. But the fact that he or she is experiencing the hindrances is in itself a good sign. It's definitely a sign for progress. And so one needs to know that this is part of the part of the practice. It's part of the path of insight, and one should accept what is happening as best as possible and work with it. And if one does so, if one simply just applies mindfulness to these hindrances long enough, then eventually they'll fade away. And so when working with these hindrances, there is a benefit that comes along with it. Namely, that one, for the first time, one becomes familiar with certain unwholesome mental states. So, if in one's ordinary worldly life, one just, buzzes around, is busy all the time, always active, there's very little time to look into the mind. There's very little time to really study what it means to have or to experience anger. And so as a result of this, one just succumbs to the anger, and then one's actions may be governed by the anger. However, on retreat, one is taking a closer look at the mind, and then one discovers these different mental states. And the first ones tend to be somewhat disappointing. Now, especially people who have a high self-esteem, thinking of themselves highly as a very pure person, they're even shocked when they take a close look into the mind and they see the mind wandering all the time, or many times, and then they find out that a number of unwholesome, rather hateful thoughts are arising in this mind. And I remember one meditator from Denmark a number of years ago back in Lumbini. He was doing social work in India with the organization of Mother Teresa. And so he considered himself as a very pure and compassionate person, always willing, always ready to help others. When this person started meditating and started to take a closer look into his mind, he was shocked. He was really shocked, and he was just about to give up the meditation practice. And another case is when you have someone who's earned a PhD, so a high educational degree, and then starts meditating, and then starts realizing, wow, there is so much wandering mind. I have such a hard time to concentrate. This can also come as a big surprise to some. So we may think of ourselves as being well concentrated, and our thinking is really logical, and so on. And then when we meditate, we find out, it's not like this at all. So this can be quite disillusioning. However, this should not be a reason to throw in the towel, but rather one should take it as a challenge and start working with the mind. And one should then try to shape or mold the mind as best as possible. Now, once a meditator has gained some familiarity with the hindrances and has learned ways of dealing with them and overcoming these same hindrances, then, and by that time also usually the pain subsides. And maybe one more practical point in terms of how the practice unfolds. Oftentimes, at the peak of experiencing the hindrances, there will also be some major pain. A meditator will battle with this pain. The meditator may even be sitting there and sweating. And this is the point when concentration gets very strong. And with this improved concentration, the hindrances get suppressed, and after a long time, some wholesome mental states start setting in or coming in. And usually, the wholesome mental states that arise following the hindrances are calmness, or to express it differently, stillness of mind, serenity, tranquility, some speak of peace of mind, and so on. And once a meditator speaks of calmness, then I'm right there to ask the next question: did you experience, let's say, some joy? And in many cases, yes, they say, joy was there. And then comes the next question: did you see some, or was there some, did you experience some clarity in the mind, or was the mind more on the foggy or cloudy or turbid side? Now, The meditator who has really overcome the hindrances will immediately say, oh, there was much clarity in the mind. So when all these signs come, and then one can conclude, now, very soon, the first insight knowledge will arise. And indeed, within the next, at the most 24 hours, a meditator will get the point. And after a couple of days of practice and having observed all the phenomena that occur in this being, in this human being, one, various phenomena such as the rising and falling movement of the abdomen and the mental states, the wandering mind and the sleepiness, the hindrances, and then the wholesome mental states, and then pains and aches, and various kinds of movements of the body, and the sweating, and what have you. And so, while observing what is coming up there, again and again and again and again, eventually one comes to the conclusion, there's nothing other than material phenomena coming up, and nothing other than mental phenomena coming up. So, in the end, there's just this materiality and mentality, mind and matter. That's all. And so, that's the point when, during the interview, the question comes, well, the rising movement is what? A mental phenomenon or a physical phenomenon? And people who practice properly will immediately say, okay, this is a physical phenomenon. And then, when the next question comes, is the observation of it and knowing the nature of it, is this a mental phenomenon or a physical phenomenon? The answer will be, well, it's a mental phenomenon. And so, and then checking with other objects, it's the same thing. And it's not only that a meditator understands this or learns to differentiate between mind and matter, but he or she will also, for the first time, understand that or experience a certain disidentification from phenomena. So the anger is no longer seen as my anger, at least at times not. And at other times, it's again, especially when my anger is strong, then the notion of my anger comes back. And so, then, in the case of pain, when asking, is it my pain or just a pain, a meditator will say, well, oftentimes it's just a pain, just a process, and nothing else. So, this is the first step on a rather longer path of, longer process of disidentifying from phenomena, detaching from phenomena. The more you manage to do this, the easier it gets to practice. And once you have a great deal of detachment in your practice, then whatever phenomenon comes up, either physical or mental, it doesn't matter. It's all okay. It's kind of just like a show that's taking place on the stage, and you're sitting, you're in the audience, and just watching the whole thing without being really involved. Now, when this disidentification process takes place, and so, at least for a few moments, a meditator sees that there is no I, then some, again, have some strong reaction. And once we had a meditator in Lumbini, from England, who, upon realizing that there is no I, she started crying tremendously. But of course, later on, she calmed down and things were okay again. So, for some people, there's a strong attachment to this notion or to the concept of an I. What does this first insight knowledge do? It at least temporarily, it removes the wrong view that a self exists independent of matter and mind. So in the end, there are just these physical processes and mental processes going on, and that's all. Now, a meditator may also understand yet a further point, and that is the interdependence of mind and matter. And a meditator will see that materiality by itself cannot do anything. It's only when mentality is there and the intentions are there, intentions to do something, that materiality can then work or perform. And so the same thing also applies the other way around. Mentality by itself cannot perform anything. And there'll be just some thinking or some intention, but without materiality to act it on, nothing will happen. And this interdependence of mentality and materiality is very nicely described in a longer verse in the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification. And there it says, just as men and women depend upon a boat for traversing the sea, so does the mind need matter for occurrence. And just as the boat depends upon men and women for traversing the sea, so too matter needs materiality needs mentality for occurrence. Depending each upon another, the boat and men and women go on the sea, and so too do mind and matter both depend the one upon the other. And so in the same Visuddhimagga, there's yet another nice illustration. And this is the illustration of a blind person and a stool-crippling man. Now, the stool-crippling man has eyes to see with. And the blind person has no eyes to see with, but legs to work with. But each one of them separately, if he or she wants to reach a certain destination, won't be able to make it. But if they join hands, so to speak, or work together, then they can reach their destination. And it happens when the stool crippling, I have to be very careful with this, the stool crippling the man climbs onto the shoulder of the blind, and then the stool crippling the man will say, leave the left, take the right, or take the right, leave the left, and then together, working together, they will be able to reach their destination. Some years ago, when I had to translate for Sayadaw Pandita in England, and he used the same illustration, I got it all mixed up. And so it was just the other way around. It was the blind person could be climbing on top of the stool crippling man. And so we had an audience that was in big laughter, and I didn't even catch it right away. So it was pretty embarrassing. But this time I got it right. So anyway, so this first insight knowledge is not only about making or coming to know some of the mental states, especially the mental defilements, And it's not only about discerning mind and matter, not only about, disidentifying to some extent from formations, and seeing the interdependence of mind and matter, but furthermore, there are two other aspects that play a vital role for the further development of a meditator. And what do you think one of these points is? Yes? That's a good point, yes. Not to develop a certain impartiality towards mental states, be they wholesome or unwholesome, but preceding this comes another important understanding. And it has to do with the mental states. What do you think? Not being attached to them. Well, yeah, that's okay. The point I'm aiming at is slightly different. Namely, for a meditator to make this distinction between unwholesome states and wholesome states, to learn to understand that, first of all, there are unwholesome states and there are wholesome states. See, if you take an ordinary person, a non-meditator, and you ask this person, well, is it okay to get angry once in a while? The person might say, oh, what's wrong with this? Never mind, that's quite okay. No, one should express one's anger. It's not good to suppress anger. So you might get answers like this. Now, what this shows is that for at least some people, there's no understanding that anger is an unwholesome mental state. And so it's taken as normal, socially accepted. And a meditator, through his or her own practice, will come to see very clearly that unwholesome mental states eventually lead to suffering, and wholesome mental states lead to happiness. Once this fundamental understanding has been gained, automatically the mind will want to let go of the unwholesome mental states. Of course, sometimes some effort is necessary, mindfulness is also necessary, and so on. But in general, there's a certain tendency there. And the mind will also understand that it's good to work towards the development of wholesome mental states. And so this is a very fundamental understanding that comes or arises out of the practice. And in the West, in some places, you ask a person, what is meant by wholesome? Some people don't even know. They're not familiar with the term wholesome or unwholesome. And so this is something, a category that is being offered or being given here, and that is very helpful for oneself. And yet another benefit that comes with the gaining of the first insight knowledge is that a meditator first of all discovers intentions. So the intention to do something, the intention to say something, and so then a meditator will be aware of such an intention, label it accordingly, and so then ideally our meditator would pause for a moment or two, and so then check. Is the action planned? Is it suitable? Is it wholesome or not? Is it suitable, beneficial or not? Suitable or not? And so if yes, then go ahead with the action plan, and otherwise one will not act on it. Once a meditator discovers these intentions and learns to spot them really quickly, then this brings about a freedom from impulsive behavior. So many people are slaves or victims of such impulsive behaviors. And you go to prisons and you talk to people there, and many of them will regret having been absent-minded during a very important point, maybe some situation that then eventually triggered violence. So as a meditator, you gain tremendously just by achieving or understanding this first insight knowledge. Now, when one, having gained the first insight knowledge, and one then continues to practice, and then again something new will gradually mature and then come up. And this is the understanding of cause and effect. So a meditator will keep observing the same physical and mental phenomena as during the previous days, and sooner or later this meditator will understand that one phenomenon will trigger or cause another phenomenon, or to put it differently, a certain phenomenon arises and there will be a resultant phenomenon. And there are plenty of such cause and effect links or relationships that occur, that might occur in the meditation practice. And just to give you one initial example, you hear, you're sitting in meditation, you're trying really hard to concentrate and to observe your rise and fall, and then there's somebody here in the meditation hall that maybe comes in and drops some item, and it falls onto the floor and causes a big bang. And so there is the sound and the hearing process, and this then may trigger an aversion or irritation in a meditator. And so this irritation obviously is linked or caused by the the dropping of an object and the sound or noise going along with it. And these different cause and effect links can be grouped into four very basic categories. And these categories are a physical phenomenon causing another physical phenomenon, a mental phenomenon, a particular mental phenomenon causing another, a different mental phenomenon, or a physical phenomenon causing a mental phenomenon, and a mental phenomenon causing a physical phenomenon. Now, let's look at these different categories. As an example, for a physical object causing a different physical object, gradually as the days go by, it gets hotter. And then as a result of this, the body starts perspiring. So the perspiration is linked to the increase in external temperature. Or when it's cold, sooner, when it's cold enough, and so you happen to be here, then the skin might crack, and might crack, and you might even develop some smaller wounds. Then, as an example for a physical object causing a mental object, a pain arises somewhere in the body, it sort of gets stronger and stronger and stronger. Eventually, it becomes excruciating, and this may lead to two results or reactions. One could be the arising of irritation, and the other one, the intention to change the posture. So, in this case, the aversion or irritation and the intention to change the posture is the result, which is a mental phenomenon, and the pain itself is physical. Now, as for a mental phenomenon causing a physical phenomenon, do you have some... Oh, not so bad. Good. Yes, it is. Yes, correct. No. And anything else? Goosebumps. Goosebumps. And, yes, three.
Intention to change posture, bring change
of
posture.
Yes, indeed. Correct. And so there are plenty. There are plenty of examples for this particular category. And then the last category is somewhat difficult, namely a mental phenomenon causing another mental phenomenon. And so the example here is that of attention, manasikara, and the seeing process. Now, let's assume you're sitting at home after a hard day of work, and you're sitting on a sofa, and you've got a table in front of you, and with dinner prepared there, and then you are watching TV. And so, while you're sitting there, the mind has different sense impressions to go to. But it there's six different sense impressions that are competing for attraction, are competing to be received and then processed by the mind. Now, it is. So there's the seeing process, you're watching TV, and there's the hearing also of the TV, and then you smell the food, and maybe you're already, you've put some morsel of food into your mouth, so you're tasting the dinner, and then you're sitting on the sofa, and there's the softness of that, and on top of that, you might be thinking about what the news are bringing. Or saying. And so the critical factor for the choice of one out of these six sense impressions is wise attention, manasikara. And this mental, depending on the selection of depending on towards which sense door this that mental factor adverts, well, depending on this, a particular sense door consciousness will arise. So, if manasikara turns towards the eye door, then the seeing consciousness, seeing consciousness or seeing process will take door, will take place. Sorry. And if instead wise attention gets adverted to the sound of the TV, then the hearing process will be predominant and will follow. So, in this situation, what we have is a particular mental phenomenon giving rise to a different mental phenomenon. Now, when a meditator understands that all physical and the mental phenomena are linked by cause and effect, and then he or she will understand that formations are not happening by chance or in a haphazard manner, nor do they occur because of the existence or the control of some supreme being, whatever form it might take. And or to put this second aspect differently, one no longer believes in a hypothetical cause. And one sees that all formations are linked by cause and effect. And so, once a meditator has understood this for the presently arising objects, and then he or she will also understand that most likely in the past it has been the same. So, in the past too, formations that occurred because of a certain causal link or relationship. And so, way of inferential knowledge, a meditator will come to the understanding that the same principle of causal links will happen or take place in the future. So, based on the present moment, one then, by inferential knowledge, comes to understand that the same causal or cause and effect relationship was valid in the past and will be valid in the future. Now, this too is an important, this insight too is an important step on the path to Nibbana. Now, of course, the practice doesn't end here, and so other insight knowledges are to follow. And tomorrow we shall continue with our with the exploration of the next insight knowledge, namely the third. And let me conclude today's Dhamma talk by wishing that through the practice of meditation, may wisdom unfold more and more, and eventually may the peace of Nibbana be yours. And this is it. As usual, yes, Irit. You can repeat this. Yeah. So, wise attention. Wise attention is a particular mental state or mental factor. And with this factor, the mind gets adverted towards a particular object. So, what you have is, there's always a number of different sense door impressions competing processed by the mind. So there's the seeing process, and there's the seeing process, hearing process, smelling, tasting, touching, and mental process. And depending on which of these sense doors the mind adverts to, or attention adverts to, depending on this, the corresponding sense door process will take place. So, if attention adverts to the eye door, then the seeing consciousness will follow. So, the seeing consciousness is the result, is the effect. And the seeing consciousness is a mental phenomenon. Wise attention, or the adverting of the mind, is also a mental phenomenon. So you have one particular mental object being the cause, and a different mental object or mental factor being the effect. Wise attention. So. No, not in the form of clever, but that one directs the mind in a wise way, towards the development of wisdom, towards the development of concentration, mindfulness, and so on. Yeah, then...
I want to ask a question about cause and effect.
What?
If somebody hurts you painfully...
Yes.
How you deal with the anger...
Is just one thing. you pay attention, you observe, you know, this anger again and again and again and again. You know, even if you get really disgusted, or until you get, you know, really fed up with it, you know, and until you can't see it anymore.
I think that my question is like,
it's your anger.
You said like, for me it's like, I know, okay, you said I'm attached to my anger, but anger is there because you know, like the question about, you know, it happened, it's not empty, something really, really happened, you know, it's not.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's a philosophical question. It's really, when it comes to anger, it's my anger. It's not, you know, it's against all we are trying. You know, all you were saying, or from the beginning of the retreat. But I try to look at my anger, but the only voice is.
You're right to be angry.
Yeah.
Yes, that's an interesting point. That's a really interesting point. See, as human beings. And as especially as non-meditators or beginning meditators or so on, we have a tendency to justify our anger. Yes, we are right to. We have a right to be angry, and we are. We are in the correct position. We have the right. We've taken the right decision, or did the right thing, whereas somebody else has done something wrong, and. And this then is taken, this then leads to a continuity of the anger. And so, please, there is absolutely no justification whatsoever for anger. No. Do not justify the anger.
I know that it will be healthy for me to look on the anger, and so I really understand that this anger is not good for me.
Well,
I understand it. It's not something that I'm not stupid. I can see that light. It's like,
oh,
it's I don't know. It's like,
so
instead of blood, it's wound the anger.
Or ego, with some events or some phenomena like anger, or some cases of anger, it may take not just a few days, but several weeks, or even several months, or even maybe a year or two to get over it. And just like some wounds heal very slowly, in the same way, the anger that you're experiencing, it may take quite some time to overcome it. And so, just be patient with yourself, and even if it comes up again and again for a long period of time, never mind. You work with it. And so, gradually, this anger will lose its momentum. No? And as you see it again and again, you will understand its structure better, or you will understand its nature better. No? And you will gradually find ways of dealing with it and overcoming it. No? This comes with time. And gradually, you will learn to see that it's, in the end, it's not my anger, but it's just anger. No, it's just a mental state of anger. And see, with practice, we also come to understand that the situation, or the cause that triggered the anger, the condition that triggered the anger, is not important. There can be a thousand different causes that might trigger anger. For one person it's this, for another person it's another thing. It's different things at different points in time.
No.
And sometimes it can be tiny little things that upset us. And so from a Vipassana point of view, don't get caught up in the cause of the anger, but rather look at the anger itself, the anger as a mental state. and know its nature. The more you manage to do this, the easier it certainly gets to let go of it. And if the anger is really strong, and so through ordinary observation or ordinary mindfulness, you cannot overcome the anger in a sitting, and then feel free to radiate loving kindness, no, metta, first of all to yourself. So then you radiate, may I be free from danger and enmity, may I be free from mental suffering, may I be free from physical suffering, and may I look out after myself happily. No? And if you keep doing this for some time, and basically you're doing samatha practice, then gradually the mind calms down. With this, the anger will calm down. And then it's the loving kindness that will take the place of the anger. No? So metta is said to be a form of adosa, of non-hatred, of non-anger. And so this loving kindness substitutes the anger. And so as long as you're doing the metta practice, it may very well happen that the anger then will vanishes. And so
you need to find a place.
You?
The one that...
Oh, later on. Later on. Enemy caused you this this harm. If this enemy is a really strong strong enemy, then it's maybe not advisable to radiate loving kindness to that person right away, because it's not most likely it's not going to work. So instead, you could do something else, and you just radiate loving kindness to all beings, no matter who it is. So that's in a very comprehensive manner. And then when you feel somewhat ready for it, you might radiate loving kindness to your enemy. The way this loving kindness meditation is done in intensive jhana practice is as follows. First, you radiate loving kindness to yourself for a day. And then you radiate loving kindness intensively to a dear person of the same sex, the same gender. And then you do this for many days. And with this you develop the jhanas. Then, once you've done that, you go on radiating loving-kindness to a very dear person, so-called Atipiya Pugala in Pali. Once you've done that, you then radiate loving-kindness to a neutral person, a person you feel neutral about, you have no particular feelings about. And once you've done that, then at the very end, when the mind is well prepared, then finally you radiate loving kindness to the enemy. And your loving kindness, your metta practice, is supposed to be successful when, after a while, there is no more barrier, inner barrier, between yourself, the dear person, the very dear person, the neutral person, and the enemy. And you are in a position to even radiate loving kindness to your worst enemy. No? So this is a gradual process in the metta practice. And so that for many people helps. No? And in your case it could also help. And while saying all of this, I remembered another point that might be very helpful for you. And this has to do with vipassana practice. So the vipassana way of dealing with anger. You see, usually it will start with a memory or a thought related to your enemy and the incident that happened X number of years ago. If your mindfulness is really sharp, and so you're really in the present moment, then you could catch that very first thought or memory, label it, and so observe it, and so then it disappears on the spot. And with this, the trigger for the anger is gone. And so then it's quite likely that the anger will not arise. No.
So what is the difference between this and suppressing the anger?
No, this is not suppressing, this is being mindful of it. No. See, if your mindfulness is quite strong, and you can catch the very first memory, then the memory will just dissolve by itself. And it's not, you're not suppressing it, you're not forcing. No, you're just looking at it, that's all. No. And so there's that. And so another really important point is, and this applies not only to anger but also to fear and depression and worries and these certain difficult mental states, namely to maintain perfect continuity of one's mindfulness, is when a person suffers from anger attacks or fear attacks, try to work on the continuity of your mindfulness. If you manage to maintain it, these unwholesome mental states have no chance to come up in the stream of consciousness. But if one moment of mindfulness is here and the next one is here, they're really closely connected, and then the next one again is connected, you'll have no hard time. But if this is one moment of mindfulness and the next one is over here, in several seconds or minutes go by, well, you can imagine how much anger or fear can come up in the meantime. So pay attention to this point. It's a really important point. Yeah. So,
can you relate to a small story about this?
Yes.
Are you still angry with your captivator, with the one who imprisoned you?
Yeah, that's a nice story. Yes.
Also,
Gaia,
what you said, isn't...
If there's a feeling of hurt, then if that's predominant coming up, then sure enough, be aware of it.
But it's not going always together. I mean that.
Connected? Yes.
Mm.
Sure.
Okay. Okay. And the other questions.
Or any more comments here too? You have a comment on this?
Comment?
On yes.
It's related to what you said. Is there in Buddhism?
Well, I don't know of any particular passage or so that would say this. No, but please, my knowledge is really limited. But I assume it's a natural thing to do. What Buddhism does teach is, if you're filled with something happens, terrible happens, and several people are, or two persons are involved in this, and anger arises, so then to be aware of this anger and not to act on it as long as it is present in the mind. So first of all, to let the anger subside before one takes any actions. And this is a very wise approach, and this you can apply to any other negative mental state. If you have a major decision to take, like let's say you're on retreat, actually you are on retreat. and then you're facing difficulties in your practice, and the mind is filled with plenty of negative mental states, and the thought comes up, okay, enough of this, I'm going. Please don't act on it. Don't act on this thought, but rather give yourself some more time, let the mind calm down, and let these negative mental states subside, and then with a clear and pure and relatively balanced mind, think it over again and then decide. Any decision taken in a state of anger or great greed or pride and conceit or whatnot most likely would be a flawed decision. Yeah? Still on Yiga's problem.
On the
Or what? Or anything? Yeah. Yeah.
Is it possible that there will be?
It may be. It may be an authentic. There may be an authentic reason for this. If really circumstances necessitate to leave, that one leaves, then go. No, if that is what it is. But like I said earlier, maybe wait a day or two to be really sure that this is the right certain course of action. Sometimes, yeah, sure enough. Sometimes there are certain conditions where it might be better for a meditator to leave.
And not because of breaking a vow.
Vow would be one. Not because of this. Or maybe also for not breaking a vow. Well, as you've noticed on this retreat, during the first few days, quite a number of meditators have left. And, and there's with an open announcement, retreat announcement. Well, anyone can come in and sign up, but in Lumbini, for instance, we don't do like this. So we select, and so when people apply through email, then usually I send them some questions back. What's your motivation for wanting to do the practice, and so on. There's other questions, and so then it becomes obvious whether a person is really seriously interested in the Vipassana or not. If yes, a person can come, but when it's an open system, anyone can come, and then so we have people who are somewhat interested, at least they think they are interested, and then they come, and then they see that they find something that doesn't suit them. So they say it's too religious, it's too this, it's too that, and so on. And so, and then they leave. Okay, if they leave, it's good. No. And so, like on this retreat, we had one person who, from the very first beginning, our very first day, was extremely restless. There was no way to tell this person, please restrain your senses and try to slow down. Do your walking meditation slowly and mindfully. Just no way to bring this message across. So eventually he left. Just go on. No. Any question? No, more to you. You want to hear something else?
I
really
wanted your answer, so I
can
think of my own answer.
I don't understand. So, now, Morty, your turn.
I also ask about emotions. Why there are some emotions that hold us very strongly, don't want to anger, for example. It's there to stay. But if you love somebody, you can hate him overnight. But if you hate somebody, you will hate him.
Indeed, this is human nature.
We have benefit to all anger.
Pardon me,
we have benefit of this. We have benefit to be angry.
Well, please, give me the please explain some more. What are the benefits of being angry or getting angry?
We feel right to be angry about this thing. We feel righteous.
Oh, we feel righteous.
Yeah.
But...
To be victim is better than be aggressor.
But if you feel, if you feel righteous about something being angry or a particular situation, then does it really help the anger? There's certain health concerns. There's also certain health concerns. It's a well-known fact.
People should find what he gained from being mad about somebody. He gained something. He must discover, investigate himself, his feeling, what he gained from being angry. Because he gained something. Otherwise, he won't hold it. He won't use it. He gained
Well, to stay with your in your words, you know, when strong anger arises, indeed one gains something, namely an opportunity to look at anger. No. So this is wonderful. No. And you can do the, you can say the same thing with all other negative mental states. No. And so to take it even one step further, if somebody else causes you some anger, be grateful to the person, because he or she teaches you to work with anger and to be patient. No. In this way, in Lumbini, I've learned so much. No. And you know the inside of stars. Anyway. There's a commentary. There's a commentary. There's a commentary to the, what was it? Some commentary on the on the perfections, the paramitas. No, the 10 perfections. And and the commentary was written by Acharya Dhammapada, if I'm not mistaken. And so each and every of those 10 perfections gets explained really nicely. One of the perfections is patience. And it says there, there are plenty of reflections being mentioned in the context of patience. And one reflection is, be grateful to the person who gives you a hard time, because he or she see him as your benefactor, because he teaches you to learn patience, not to become more patient. And if you see it in this way, the whole story changes. So yes,
I think it would be more
for sure. No particular, no specific mental state that covers hurt, or there's no one specific mental state that is known as hurt. In my impression, but I may be wrong, please, it's not 100%, is that it would come as one manifestation or one one aspect of anger. And see, from a Buddhist point of view, Buddhist Abhidhamma, anger covers the whole range of not just aggressive anger or ill will or hatred or rage, but also the secondary forms or sinking type of passive forms of anger, such as sadness and fear and depression. And that's where the hurt would probably fit in. And no doubt, there will be plenty of other ways of working with anger, and modern psychology has surely developed ways of doing this. So there's nothing to say there. Yeah, even the hurt of feeling hurt, you look at it and then you work with it, and after a while you find that your mind calms down, and then even this feeling of hurt is gone, it dissolves. Sometimes it's just a matter of mindfulness and time. And see, when on a retreat, even though one is spending the day in silence, yet small little things may happen, and one may get offended because another meditator does something, is noisy, and so on, and so the mind oftentimes magnifies this, and then one can work oneself into even a rage just because of some negligible matter. And so if one then just, without doing anything, without hugging anyone, without seeking another person's loving kindness or compassion or whatnot, if one just keeps observing, you know, the whole thing, the whole issue, then sooner or later it will, you know, disappear. You know, to give you an illustration for these, when I became, you know, just a few weeks after becoming a monk in, you know, Burma, I was staying at the Mahasi Meditation Center there, and so in the Foreigner's Lodge. And not being very well acquainted with the monastic vows, so I made a mistake. And then in that Foreigner's Lodge there was a table with all sorts of drinks on it, Horlicks and coffee and tea and maybe some chocolate or so, which was kept there for the monks to be taken only after after this object had been offered, and only during the morning hours. That's part of the rules. And so there was some item, I forgot what, coffee or so, that I was craving for at the time. And so there was nobody around to offer the coffee. So in my greed for the coffee, I took the jar of coffee, went outside where some construction workers were, and gave the poor jar of coffee to the worker and said, "Please offer this to me." Thinking, it's stupid, of course, but thinking that with this I have observed the rule of that everything needs to be offered, you know, just like the food here, it has to be offered. You've seen it at breakfast and lunchtime. And unfortunately, there was a Malaysian fellow meditator there, or he was also bhikkhu. He saw this whole thing. He came up to me and said, "Please listen, this is not the way to do it. This is absolutely wrong, and don't ever do like this." And that, it's a minor thing, you know. But I was so terribly offended by the whole thing, you know. And there was a tremendous amount of hurt, you know. It went really deep, deep, deep inside. And I spent about 2 days working with the whole thing. And it was so bad that I couldn't even sit anymore. No. And I had to do walking meditation, fast walking meditation, pacing up and down, up and down. I was at the point of even wanting to kill this person. You know, just to think of the thought. No, and of course I didn't do it, but it was pretty bad. But eventually the whole thing dissolved, and we later on we became good friends. So the Vipassana way of working with anger does work. There are modern psychological ways of working with anger, but there's also this method for the Vipassana approach. Okay, yes, Shai.
A remark. What about the first question about to observe anger or hurt or whichever mental state arises? Sometimes it might be misunderstood.
Oh, yeah.
Understand that it's not so holy, yeah? That it's very basically rooted in self. We find, yeah? That it's much more conditioned to act in certain ways, just like myself. And so that makes it much
easier. You're saying your attitude towards this person, that's like you react to
rooted in understanding. Understanding that person. It's just like fire, in a very deep sense.
It's
just like fire.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, no. Another person, the other person who's giving you a hard time, is doing this out of ignorance. And once you see this, then compassion can come in, and then in the end you can forgive. Okay. Now, time is much advanced already. It's, as usual, way past 7 o'clock. So let's end at this point.
Ah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.